Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew Hare, on behalf of Eric Bonnie. I intend to address the first issue raised in Mr. Bonnie's briefs with respect to the trial court's refusal to instruct on the constitutional defense of self-defense with respect to the possession of a weapon by previous offender or palpo charge in this bifurcated trial that he is appealing from. The constitutional self-defense under Article 2, Section 13 focuses on the purpose of possession. It asks the question whether the purpose of possession was for defense of oneself, property, or home. It doesn't ask about reasonableness. It doesn't ask about the imminence of a threat. It doesn't ask anything other than whether the defendant's purpose in possessing the weapon, the firearm in this case, was for the purpose of defense of oneself, for property or person.
Well, Mr. Hare, when Mr. Bonnie attempted to find the weapon and get it unloaded, he wasn't possessing it for purposes of self-defense, was he?
Well, certainly the state's view is to take that part of the scenario or the situation, the event, and to focus on that. But the principle, in light of the fact that we're dealing with self-defense, is that the court, and including the state, should review the evidence in a light most favorable to the defendant. So as part of the scenario and the situation, certainly when Mr. Bonnie was discussing with the police officer what was occurring or what occurred during this event with his wife in his home, that was probably his immediate intention, at least at the outset. Obviously that changed, and according to him in his statement, his wife accosted him. He related it, which she confirmed in her testimony, that she had threatened him in the past, she had assaulted him in the past, and that in this particular case she did threaten that if she got the gun, she was going to shoot him. So this scenario unfolded, and so it's not untrue that yes, part of the statement was that his original intention, if you will, was to retrieve the gun to try and disarm it, if you will, to remove the ammunition, but that didn't happen. So that's part of it, but that's not all of it. And the principle is, in the light most favorable to Mr. Bonnie, is there some evidence? The second principle is there some evidence. A scintilla, cases discuss that principle as being exceedingly low, and that's all that's required. It's not a question of sufficiency. It's not a question of whether Mr. Bonnie would have succeeded. It's not a question of whether the jury would have agreed with Mr. Bonnie. It's a question of, is there some evidence to support the giving of this instruction? And yes, there is. So for example, if we pull ourselves back and we said, well, we're not going to go to a bifurcated trial, we're going to try these charges together, keeping in mind that it's bifurcated because of the prejudice that might endure from the introduction of his prior convictions with respect to the palpo charge. If these charges have been tried together, there's no question that the court would have instructed on this. It's for the jury to decide. There's some evidence to support this instruction.
Pardon me for interrupting.
Sure.
That raises the issue of the Attorney General's argument that there was a self-defense instruction in the first part of the trial.
Correct.
And the jury's verdicts obviously rejected that self-defense instruction because they convicted on two counts. So how does that play into your argument that he should have gotten an additional self-defense instruction for the palpo case?
Well, first, immediately, the issues, the questions are different. One is the purpose behind the possession. The second issue with respect to the statutory form of defense of physical force, use of physical force, basically asks the question of reasonableness. So, for example, in Instruction 23, which dealt with the attempted reckless manslaughter offense for which Mr. Bonnie was convicted, it discussed, and actually is quite adequate in terms of discussing or telling the jury, informing the jury, that the prosecution must prove beyond reasonable doubt in order to prove recklessness that Mr. Bonnie did not act in reasonable self-defense. So let's say, for example, and accept that the jury has decided he didn't act in reasonable self-defense. Well, we have that verdict. Then we have the heat of passion, first-degree assault. Heat of passion in Colorado is recognized in many ways in a kind of a colloquial way as an imperfect self-defense. What we do know from that verdict also, from this additional verdict, is that Ms. Bonnie, his wife, caused or committed a serious and highly provoking act, which is in you know, so that Mr. Bonney, in response, may not have acted reasonably, or at least the jury's finding that. So the question of reasonableness is not the question of whether it's purpose. In fact, they're not inconsistent. Certainly, Mr. Bonney could, at the outset, when he's struggling with his wife, at that moment, have the purpose to possess this weapon to protect himself. Now, he may have acted unreasonably in the discharge of the weapon. The jury's finding it was reckless. The jury's finding it's in the heat of passion, that is, that his wife provoked this conduct by him. He's acting unreasonably, but his purpose behind having possession of the weapon at that moment certainly can be for the purpose of defending himself. They're not inconsistent.
Is it your theory then that his right of self-defense arose when he and his wife began struggling for the weapon? Or what is your theory as to when it arose?
Well, again, it gets back to one of the disconnects here is that we're dealing with verdicts that arguably aren't really relevant, that in the sense that they're not law of the case, they're not prior relevant legal rulings as the trial court ruled and as the state is trying to argue here. They're not legally or logically inconsistent. That is to say, a jury could, if a jury were to have been properly instructed on the constitutional defense with respect to Pavo, and return a verdict of not guilty, that's not inconsistent, legally or logically inconsistent with the verdicts that they return with regard to the conduct or behavior in the situation when he's involved with his wife. So to answer your question, that's at least a preface to it, is that in the light most favorable to Mr. Bonney, as I was discussing, I think, earlier in his statements to police as this scenario unfolded, it escalated. Obviously, they have a very volatile relationship. He discussed and she confirmed that they have gone back and forth and threatened one another, and she has assaulted him, and she was threatening to shoot him if she got the gun. That alone, at that moment, he has the right to possess that weapon. When she tells him that if I get that weapon, I'm going to shoot you, that's obviously, not only is that raising self-defense vis-a-vis the charges, the original charges of attempted second-degree murder and first-degree assault, certainly with respect to a Palpo charge, the jury should at least decide, be able to decide whether he's possessing, at least at that moment, and then beyond, for the purpose of self-defense and defending himself.
Mr. Hare, I want to get back to this notion that there are various aspects of possession. Was the possession by Mr. Bonney, I mispronounced his name.
That's fine, Judge.
Was the possession by Mr. Bonney at the time he hid the gun enough to convict him on the Palpo charge?
Well, the charging document that I have here with me indicates it's the same date as the date of the offense, the other offense.
Well, assuming he hit it on the same day.
I think that's up to the jury. In the manner in which this unfolded and in which the factual scenario is unfolding, both the possession and use of the weapon, the jury is being asked to make that question, to make that call. And whether the prosecution makes that argument and argues that is a relevant consideration for the jury, maybe they do, maybe they don't. The question, though, gets back to, and again, I think, just to follow up with the thought on that, is that the question is whether there's sufficient evidence, whether the jury would have actually acquitted. It's up to the jury. So in the light most favorable to Mr. Bonney, is there some evidence to support the giving of it? Yes, there is. That might be a relevant argument the prosecution might make.
Here's the point that I'm thinking about. That is, if there is enough evidence that he possessed the gun when he hit it to support a conviction, then how's he harmed by not giving the self-defense instruction?
Well, again, that contrary evidence, if you will, if that were, for example, that's why I would characterize that as a potential prosecution argument, that this scenario would include that's not the question before the court in the terms of whether this affirmative defense should go to the jury. So when we take the principle that it's in the light most favorable to Mr. Bonney, keep in mind that Colorado self-defense is a obviously a very critical defense. It's constitutionally protected, and in this particular instance, dealing with firearms and in the home, it's a relevant question, and it's important in Colorado. And so while that might be an argument the state might make below or make in response to Mr. Bonney's assertion that he was possessing for the purpose of defending himself. It doesn't answer the real question before this court, which is there some evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Bonney to support the giving of the instruction? Again, Mr. Bonney doesn't have to say the jury would have acquitted him if given this instruction. It doesn't have to say that those aren't valid arguments. They might be. The jury might accept it. They might not. But that doesn't answer the question that the trial court really answered when it gave the self-defense instructions, the physical statutory verbal defense of self-defense. Certainly, those might have been all valid arguments that the state made below, and I'm sure they did in their arguments. But it didn't say, that doesn't answer the question, in light most favorable to Mr. Bonney, is there some evidence to give this instruction? Yes, there is. That's the end of it, really. And in a new trial, that might be an argument the state might make. And they might say, that's the end of it, you shouldn't go any further, or you should add that into the mix in deciding whether it's really his purpose or not. I see I have about 4 minutes left. If the court has no further questions, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, and may it please the court, John Lee, on behalf of the people, bar number 3141. Three independent considerations resolve this case. First, the trial court correctly concluded that the jury's verdicts in the first trial foreclosed the affirmative defense to count the homicide trial. Second, no evidence supported giving the affirmative defense on the Calpo homicide trial. And third, even assuming that the trial court should have given the instruction, overwhelming evidence established that the defendant was not acting within the affirmative defense, so therefore any error was harmless. With respect to the first, I think there are two analytically independent arguments presented to the court on whether or not the jury's first verdicts foreclosed the issue in the second trial. In the opening brief, the defendant kind of focused on factual inconsistency, that the general verdicts did not provide a basis for the trial court to decide that the issue had been resolved in the first trial, so it not be presented in the second trial. The second argument, which I think was focused more on the reply brief and kind of presented today, is that there's a legal inconsistency between the jury's first verdicts and with the trial court's decision that foreclosed the jury from considering the third defense of Calpo. I think the trial court was correct on both grounds.
Counsel, isn't there a different mental state involved in acquiring the gun for self-defense and using the gun for self-defense? Couldn't the jury have found he acquired it for self-defense, but that at the time he actually used it, he wasn't acting in self-defense? I mean, aren't those two different questions?
I think the fundamental question as it deals here is the purpose for the possession. When we look at cases like Bloom Ford, which is kind of what created this affirmative defense, there's a quote in Ford which says, however, the Calpo can validly regulate and restrict the possession of a firearm if it's not used for a constitutional manner. So in this case, in the first trial, what the jury found was that the defendant used his gun to commit a crime of first-degree assault. Nothing about the Second Amendment makes it constitutional to use a gun for the purpose of an assault. So,
pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Winger, but I don't want to say I can read Judge Nieto's mind, but I think what he's getting at is Mr. Hare made the following argument. You have this sort of timeline, this temporal timeline, and you have at the first time that Mr. Bonney picks up the gun, there's evidence in the record to suggest that his wife has already threatened him. And so at that point, I think Mr. Hare's argument continues, at that point he's entitled to possess the weapon for self-defense. However, it's not inconsistent for the jury to subsequently say, it may have been okay for you to pick it up, but intervening events and your conduct in those intervening events indicate that you weren't entitled to self-defense when you pulled the trigger. Could you address that directly?
Yeah, and let me hit that a couple of different ways. I guess I would disagree with the premise to juxtaposing those two different events. I don't think there's any evidence to support that when the defendant first hid the gun, that he did so under direct threats. When we look at cases dealing with the amount of evidence you need to raise the affirmative Calpo defense, I think this case is very close to Barber, where general threats are not enough. Rather, as cases like DeWitt make clear, you need affirmative evidence that the defendant actually possessed the gun at the time charged for the purpose of defense of self on the property. And general threats that have looked at threatening him in the past or assaulted him in the past provide no basis for why the defendant hid the gun on that day of the date that's charged. So I don't think there was any evidence for the instruction to the first event. Because I think when we break down the case, we have, I guess, arguably three different events with the gun. We have the hiding of the gun, we have the defendant's testimony that he was going to give the gun to his wife, and then we have the evidence from the statement that his wife then threatened to shoot him if she got hold of the gun, and then he shot her. If we look at those three events, the only one which I think arguably, although there wasn't sufficient evidence for the instruction, is the third, when she actually makes the threat that if he doesn't shoot her, she's going to shoot him. So I don't think there's enough evidence in the first two events to justify the current self-defense instruction. So to directly answer Judge Nando's question, I think the jury, it was probably not presented to the jury because there's no basis for the jury to find that the possession of the gun when he hid the gun raised affirmative defense of Aldo. More fundamentally, legally, in regards to whether the two charges are legally inconsistent, I still think it goes back to whether or not the trial court correctly found that because the defendant did not use the gun, as the jury found, for a constitutional purpose, whether then Palco could then come back and cure that conviction as an affirmative defense. However far the affirmative defense of Palco goes, it doesn't create an absolute right to use a gun in whatever manner someone chooses. And the best example I can think of is, let's take a bifurcated aggravated robbery trial, where a defendant gets convicted of aggravated robbery. In the second Palco trial, the defendant admits that he committed aggravated robbery with a gun, but also testifies that, of course, he also had a gun to protect himself against the victims, because why would they potentially attack him? After all, he's robbing them with a gun. I don't think there'd be any dispute that in that situation, the Palco firm defense shouldn't cover the possession of the gun. And the reason is because it's not being used in a constitutional legal manner. And that's exactly what we have in this case, because by finding that the defendant committed the crime of first degree assault, the jury necessarily already found that when he used the gun and possessed the gun, he did not do so within a constitutional purpose. In particular, the constitutional purpose of within the Second Amendment. So there's nothing factually or legally inconsistent about the jury's first verdicts foreclosing the Palco issue in the second trial. Second, and closely related, even if we ignore the verdicts, I've kind of gone through this, but there's no evidence to support the instruction at the outset. What we have here is not at all tantamount to cases where the Palco instruction was given. In this case, not only was there no direct evidence that the defendant possessed the gun for protection of self, home, or property, but his account actually was the exact opposite. As his account and the defense area trial was, he got the gun because he was sick of his wife, Maggie. So far from presenting affirmative evidence that he possessed it for a proper Second Amendment purpose, his account actually provided a completely independent account, which isn't covered by the Second Amendment. Third, even assuming that the instruction should have been given to the jury, any error was harmless considering the overwhelming evidence establishing that the defendant's conduct did not fall within the affirmative defense. The defendant's own theory and account did not provide that it was for a private Second Amendment purpose. He hid the gun, which isn't covered by the Second Amendment, and then his testimony was that he was giving the gun to his wife because he was scared of her nagging him. I think what's interesting is if we kind of take the defense argument to its conclusion, the jury, in order to acquit the defendant on the affirmative defense, would have had to have found that the defendant possessed the gun for self-defense, and he did so to protect himself against his wife. And he did that by getting the gun to give it to his wife who was threatening him. So I think we look at the evidence, even assuming that the instruction should have been given, there's no way that a reasonable jury would have believed it. So then here it was harmless. And if the court has no further questions, that should affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Hare, you have 4 minutes and 10 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. opposing counsel uses a refrain about the jury's verdict reflecting that he did not use it for a constitutional purpose and it was not being used in a constitutional manner, that this is somehow a bar. The constitutional defense does not ask whether he's using it for a constitutional purpose or whether he's using it in a constitutional manner. It simply asks whether his purpose in possessing was for the purpose of defense. I think Your Honor's discussion or presentation of the factual scenario in what is the subsequent belief or potential purpose on Mr. Bonney's part in possessing the weapon for the purpose of defense, and then not acting reasonably, which the verdicts arguably reflect, that's what happened here. But again, in a light most favorable to Mr. Bonney, there is some evidence to support the giving of this instruction, and the jury should have been able to decide, based upon what opposing counsel discusses as the three events, whether those are all three events that are relevant to the jury's consideration, determination of the issue. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But the real issue is before this court, is there some evidence in the light most favorable to Ms. Bonney to support giving of the instruction? Yes, there is, and the jury should have decided the particular issue in this case. If the court has no further questions, I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Bonney's outlaw conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Hare. Thank you again, Mr. Lee. Thanks to both counsel for excellent arguments. They were helpful to us. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.